Welcome to The Watching Dead, the officially unofficial podcast for The Walking Dead on AMC. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 9, Episode 15, titled The Calm Before. Aaron, do you know what half of the statement comes after that?
Before the slumber.
Damn, you're right. So, I was hoping for an exciting episode next week, but the slumber sounds like a bad, bad, just low-key episode.
Yeah, but sometimes it's followed by a storm, and those things can be very exciting events, and fuck a lot of people up, you know.
That's true. Speaking of fucking a lot of people up, wow, this episode, they really pulled out all the stops with the character deaths, huh?
Yeah, and this is probably the most affecting character death we've seen since the Tombs episode, where Lori, despite the fiesta party, actually managed to, you know, her death and Carl's reaction to it and all that stuff, we managed to, you know, hit an emotional mark. I think Carl generated a little bit, but I tell you what, and it wasn't, it was like the order of these, you know, when you see the faces like from a distance and you're coming up to them and the highwaymen, I'm like, oh, okay, that's going to be the, you know, I actually like these guys. I'm bummed that Samson's dead now.
Yeah.
But it just kept on getting worse until the end where I was like, oh my God, are they going to show, is Rosita going to be up there? Holy shit.
Uh-huh.
And instead it's Enid and then Henry. And, you know, I don't really care about Henry very much, but, you know, I care a lot about Carol and Daryl. And Daryl trying to shield Carol from the hideous sight of that.
he comes and just running in screaming, nah, nah.
Nah, Dalek, nah. It actually got some waterworks going. I got choked up just because Melissa McBride and Norman Reedus made me care about them caring for each other. And it's a hell of an episode, I thought. A lot of problems. In fact, the first, I don't know, third of this episode, I'm like, wow, there's a lot of like cheesy Walking Dead things that they're kind of falling back into, which, you know, I kind of expect. They're not going to make a clean break with the old regime. But by the end of the episode, I'd taken all those words back. It was really, really affecting and well done.
Yeah. And I liked the way they did the reveal on that. I liked kind of the intercutting between the, you know, the scenes of hope that Sadiq is trying to give them at the end, you know, the story he's telling as opposed to the story Alpha wanted him to tell. I thought all that stuff mostly worked, you know. It's a change. It's something I'm getting used to with The Walking Dead, which is being mildly impressed with what they're doing as opposed to thoroughly disappointed.
Yeah, and there was like some really pretty shots. I thought that final shot of Lydia and Daryl on the hilltop was real nice to look at and evocative, like so many shots this year have been. They're just, you know, not like, hey, we need to get this shot. The sun's shining. It doesn't really fit the mood. Oh, well, like, I don't know whether they're just sweating the details or they're getting really fortunate with the weather. But like when they set up a brooding, isolated, lonely shot like that, it actually makes me feel it rather than, you know, just derision that they're trying to do something above their pay grade. Even this, I kind of started feeling like, oh, they're just jumping around all kinds of times. And like, this is the old trick to make something, you know, that doesn't really land, try to land. It's going to be clumsy. But no, like, it was a little confusing, but like, I understand why they did it, because it perfectly aligned all the gut punches in a way that they couldn't if they just told it. So like, they actually had a reason to break the chronological flow rather than trying to, like, you know what? It's cool when Tarantino does it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is weird. It is weird to they explicitly and specifically praise the show for doing basic drama things right. But goddamn, they got me. They got me.
No, the other death that, you know, we didn't mention is Tara. And that's maybe the biggest gut punch for me. Like, Enid's been such a minor character. Even when she's had like her JSS moment in the sun, she's been relegated to the background most of the time.
That's true.
Tara has been like stepping forward this season, and I was getting invested in seeing Tara be the leader of the hilltop, and now she's done. Like, I That's disappointing.
Yeah, I wish they'd flipped it and Boston Rob's head is on that spike, because I like Enid. I like it. I always thought that, you know, I shipped her and Carl. I thought they were cute together. You know, the way she that she's handled some of the shit that they've given her. I thought she, yeah, I really like Enid, and I was kind of. It's wild because, like, I thought when they were panning from her, it was going to be to Rosita, you know, when Gabe was like, hey, yeah. Have you seen blah, blah, blah? I'm wanting to talk. Oh, no, they went from there to Tara. And I'm like, oh, my God, it's not. It's but yeah, like what Tara's been around since what, season 4?
Yeah, the prison with the governor. Uh huh.
So, and you know, not exactly a fan favorite, but I always liked Fist Bump. I liked it when she was a joke. I liked it when she pivoted to a serious character. I liked mm-hmm. her stepping forward to be in a leadership role. And I thought the show, I wonder how many of these deaths actually felt painful to the actors, because they're like, oh God, I'm finally getting decent material. And, you know, it's like Tara is the version of give this person an insane amount of backstory in one episode, except for one season.
Sure.
But that works really well. And even Brett Butler, right? Mm. Brett Butler. They did a lot with the blacksmith couple, Mr. and Mrs. Blacksmith, and gave him a baby and gave him hope after they'd been through so much. And, you know, her going down like a hero. That's the other thing. I like that these people were, you know, I was moved because they were victims, but then I was moved again when I found out that they all went out like heroes. And, mm-hmm. you know, Sadiq kind of lionizing them reminded me of that one-eyed Spartan that returned to tell the tale of the Battle of Thermopylae and inspire the whole, like, you know, you're just waking a sleeping giant with this shit, Alpha.
Yeah, this, that was there's the other so thing much I, stuff that happens in this episode, because, yeah, that's a whole other can of worms, right?
I was going to say.
The storm that's shaping up here. It's to me, like, I feel like season 8 of The Walking Dead, you'd have these 10 pikes, and there would be, like, 6, you know, 9 of them would be characters we've hardly ever even spoken to or seen mm-hmm. on screen, and the 10th one would be somehow Rick. Like Rick's head would show up on there and they would never explain it. It'd just be like there and gone. Mm-hmm. And then they'd have this big shocking moment. Negan would come up and hit it with a baseball bat, tee it up. Like, I don't know. Season 8 would have been a train wreck if they tried this.
Mm-hmm. But instead, like maybe 3, maybe I'd say 3 of the people's heads on pikes. Even Angus Simpson, they named him after he's dead, but like I liked him. He's the highwayman. So I recognized him. I'm sad he's not going to be a bigger part of the show. Like him with his wrench of fury, that's some pulp goodness. I liked it. But yeah, like the redhead that kind of took a shine to Henry this episode. Angus Simpson's number 2. Angus Simpson's number 3. Who cares? But a surprising number of them landed, and you know, the ones that landed, probably half of those, they just kind of breathed life into this season. So
I'm surprised they didn't take out one of the FNGs, one of the, like Connie or somebody.
I really was thinking.
I feel like that would have united all these groups, right? Like, now everyone suffered losses together. This is no longer like they've had their losses and they've had their losses separately. It would have brought everybody together in more, I don't know, in a stronger bond, but.
Okay. Yeah, no, I thought it was interesting how the community bonded together to do this, like, NATO doctrine that attack on one of us is an attack on all, and then fucking Alpha went and attacked them all.
Yeah.
Used this opportunity that the carnival gave her, the fair, which I really liked, to strike at all the communities at the same time. And I like you, I thought it was kind of wild that they didn't kill any of the FNGs. But I don't know, maybe that's like that could possibly generate some drama, that there's a little jealousy and resentment there, or it might, like, I feel like the FNGs are like super motivated to earn their spot, and that this might even motivate them to like even greater levels of heroism and doing daring do, because they'll feel that weight, like that survivor's guilt, you know, that these communities took us in, this all shit started happening, we got to fight for our new homes, right? So yeah,
could be. And they're going to need somebody to step up in Hilltop, and you know they're living in Hilltop, so I think.
And then Lydia, like, oh God, like she's going to be a central figure whether she wants it or not.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that the young people community are probably primed to be real dicks to her. I don't know.
They don't exist anymore, do they? Like, that's half true. Of them were killed in that dude.
There's one callow teenager left in the whole fucking town.
Oh, and he's quaking in his boots, man. His two buddies just got murdered.
Right. I guess he's Hilltop and she's going to live in Alexandria.
Okay.
It does suck that they killed, like, so many of the teenagers, because they could have done some interesting stuff with that, too. But I guess, yeah, one way to do this is liquidate them all and just have Lydia remain.
Yeah, I mean, Henry's gone, Gage and Rodney are gone. Addie's gone too. Like, they killed four out of the five teens that we know.
No. They left one of the teenage jackasses alive.
Yeah, the blonde one.
The blonde one. Yeah, the blonde bang punk. But the others, yeah, they liquidated. It's him and Lydia. That's it. That's it for the teenagers, as far as I can tell.
Is he Gage? Is that his name?
I don't know. I'm not. They're going to have to. I grant people's names when I start caring about them.
Yeah.
Connie got her name 2, 3, 4 episodes ago. Mm-hmm. I think all the FNGs now are named. I got the last one, Kelly, because she had a real good scene with Connie, who I now give a shit about. So, like, blonde bang punk, chubby cheek punk. Now you're Dr. Disrespect throwaway line until I actually give a shit about you, which is probably going to be never.
Yeah. Yeah, he'll be dead before you care about him, because he's a shitbag.
Yeah.
I just learned Yumiko's name, too. So, like, they haven't done a great job giving them enough meat for me to chew on and learn their names.
And here's a controversial statement. The professor is still the professor to me. Boston Rob's still Boston Rob.
Okay.
Like, they have the FNGs, and I'm Boston Rob, you're still an FNG. I remember when you're a whiny ass in a cage.
With Gregory. That wasn't
that many episodes ago.
Stand it up for that guy.
Yeah, eat a dick. I'll give you a name when I start caring about you. And it's not, you know, I start to care about you because Enid cared about you. Enid's left the building. Fuck you, Boston Rob. You're still Boston Rob.
All right. We should probably get into the recap here.
That's the calm before the podcast, let me tell you. We're just going to unleash the howling beast now.
Here comes the slumber. All right, there are a couple of people killing walkers on their anniversary. They roll up on the Hilltop and become active members of the community before they celebrate another anniversary. There's a carving scene or something in here. I don't know. They load up a cart and they leave for the fair. Unfortunately, they're murdered along the way by Whispers.
They're riding out with chests full of hope and love, and they end up getting skinned for their trouble.
Hope literally dashed here.
Yeah, this is the hope chest spilled on the ground. This is stupid. I don't like this anniversary motif. It just didn't work. Like, they realized they'd painted themselves into a Walking Dead corner of like, ah, fuck, we've kind of made this button a thing, and it was kind of like a Henry and Lydia thing, and now we want to make it a we don't have any support for that. Like, shit, can we do something with anniversaries and that kind of theme? And no, you can't. You can't.
Did these symbols ever work? Like, if you make them so obvious, like if you say, hey, look at this, everybody. This is hope. You see this pendant here that we've got? It's hope. And you spell like it out Superman's that much. S. Can it ever feel not cheesy when they try and do something like this?
No, like the first payload is supposed to land when, you know, Lydia flashed it to Henry to show that she was saw. But you even the man watching this episodes twice and taking notes and doing a podcast fucking whiffed on that. So like, no, that. And this trying to like turn it into a broader kind of like Superman's. Oh, on my planet, this means hope. No, it's dumb. But it does work because Alpha using this lady's skin and like hair and all that and stuff clothes. To walk amongst the living the way she walks amongst the dead was a very tasty thematic tie-in that I quite enjoyed. So blonde anniversary lady died so that Alpha's character can live.
Hilda is her name.
Hilda.
I'm sure you Hilltop.
Hilda Hope Hilltop. That's her name for real, Hilda.
Uh-huh.
Hilda Hilltop.
I don't think her last name is Hilltop, but yeah.
Prove me wrong.
I can't. Hilda Hilltop. I really can't.
No, no. She's hippie blonde girl that got scalped and she's dead. And her name's gone like tears in the rain.
All right. Ezekiel begins the fair with a speech about what Rick and Carl built, and he spots Carol on her way out to find Henry. Michonne shows up with everyone in tow, so there's no need to go out. Carol sees Judith for the first time in years. Tara's pissed that Lydia was brought to the fair, and Michonne says, "We need to talk." Which will be the next scene.
You cut Jesus completely out of the memorial leader speech that Ezekiel gave.
You know, Jesus, I don't know. Look, Rick is the George Washington here, right? Like, he's the guy that everybody is going to give credit for building this community. Jesus is second fiddle at best. He's a Hamilton.
He's saying he's Adams, President Adams?
Sure,
Madison.
Yeah. That's about the caliber of Jesus here, yeah.
Hey, look, Jesus had to die so that Tara could live, so that she could die, so that Lydia could live.
So that Daryl
okay?
could get pissed and kill some more survivors.
Yeah. I liked Ezekiel addressing everybody like the king with the paper mache tiger, like menacing everybody. His speech was pretty good, you know, like Rick Grimes destroyed the bridge to save us all. Mm-hmm. And though that river crossing might be gone, we've built a bridge nonetheless. The trade continues to feel shoehorned onto this event when he's like, eat, drink, trade, be merry. Like, get what? Come on.
What does trade mean?
Trade fair?
Well, yeah. Okay, this is like my number one question about this fair is how are they trading? Because Tara makes it clear. She goes in, she fist bumps everybody, says, none of you getting paid, none of you getting paid, none of you getting paid. How are they trading anything? What do these people have to trade? If I'm standing
Hilltop,
if I'm standing guard at the top
wedges,
of a fence, I got nothing. I got a stick, maybe. And once I trade that for a ham hock, I'm done.
Yeah, it's kind of like when Star Trek, where they establish that they're in a post-scarcity, post-currency economy, and yet they're still playing poker and trading Federation credits and stuff. Like, what? Wait, what is this? Seems like capitalism with extra steps. I don't understand. That's a good question. I mean, clearly I think it's supposed to be like a Burning Man type of deal where you have durable goods and you can trade them for art and you can trade them for innovations. And you know what it did? It felt just like any of these small time county or small town fairs in Indiana or Ohio. Like, oh, it's the Apple Butter Festival because here's the EMT with a booth encouraging you to learn CPR and change your fucking batteries, you know, every 3 months or whatever you're supposed to do once a year on the solstice. I don't know. I forget what you're supposed to do.
And your smoke
detectors? What the big date. Yeah, your smoke detectors, and you've got a blacksmith selling his shit and trying to, you know, selling you Mall Ninja stars and whatnot, and you've got your food, your elk, you know, your sides of elk and whatnot. It didn't feel like something vital, except for I think it was a mistake to portray the kingdom as failing. It should have just been that, like, they've all been isolated and they're weaker that way, and this is a reforging of their brotherhood and their sisterhood, their family.
Well, they've never actually portrayed the kingdom as failing. They've only said the kingdom is failing.
Yes, where all the other stuff about them not, like, being there for each other and just, like, big stuff and small stuff, you know? Just, like, they're not putting forth the effort, I think, is all that you needed to do. So, like, the trade always felt shoehorned on this, and... Yeah. It made the speech that wasn't really inspiring kind of sound mercantile and corporate. It was weird.
Huh. Okay.
I did love Jerry's backronym of the first annual intercommunity reunification fair.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
The fair.
But, yeah. Better than Ezekiel's Fair of New Beginnings. What the fuck?
I don't know. This is the first one, though. I did have that question. Like, is this something they've been doing for the last 6 years, or is this the first one? No, it's first annual.
I felt like did we sell our world building so much that this was, there's more than this? But I thought they implied maybe they were doing these on a fairly regular basis until the Scars Edict went up.
Maybe.
But yeah, I thought that was confusing too. Why with the CGI doves? Did you notice that?
No.
not only were they CGI, but two of them were doing the identical, they were the identical model and the identical animations, like their wingtips were synchronized. And like, it's not that hard to release six doves, man. Like David Copperfield does it in every fucking Magic Act he does. And he's just a Vegas show. Like what, you can't get 6 to 10 real doves and just release them. I couldn't, like, this show does not want to fuck with animal wranglers. It's just not going to do it. Dogs. How hard is it to get 3 or 4 fucking trained dogs in Hollywood? They got to have 100 at any one time, but they'll just CGI dogs and stuff. It's a weird, weird fixation for this show that does so much stuff practically.
The other thing that I like about this scene is when Lydia sees how Henry's greeted by his mother when he shows up.
Yeah.
It's getting a hug instead of a slap. It's like, you know, the contrast couldn't be more stark. I just enjoyed seeing that.
They continue to do that to show like that this is just better, you know, like Alpha's bullshit is just that. It's just bullshit. You can't.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like that's not even living. If that's what life is, then you might as well eat a bullet because it's not. And yeah, that's one thing they do effortlessly. Like if 9 out of 10 of those people would give up walking with the dead right now, if they could get inside the kingdom for 1 second.
Oh, yeah.
Which I had this I had this joke that I was making with myself. I wish you were there. You'd enjoyed it. As Alpha's walking amongst all the fairgoers, I kept on thinking how funny it would be if she just like, you know what? I'm just going to stay. I'm just going to make all this permanent. I'm Deborah now. Hey, I'm from Alexandria. I want to stay in Hilltop and just ghost the rest of the people. She just never comes back. Yeah. She's like shopping and getting it like, oh, this is a bites into her first Carl heirloom freedom and hope tomato. And it's like, nope, this I'm not going back to Grubbs. Fuck it. Fuck it. These people don't smell like dead assholes. I'm staying.
Up next, the Council of Leaders convenes with Michonne apologizing for the time she spent as an isolationist. Alexandria grants asylum to Lydia, who's grateful. Tara's pissed because her community will bear the consequences of this decision, and they agree to send some of their fighters to Hilltop for protection. The Michonne proposes a mutual protection pact, and everyone agrees to that, and they seal the deal by signing Michonne's charter, which it's surprising to her that thing still existed.
Was treacherously stolen from the coffers of Alexandria and delivered unto the enemy.
Here's the other neglected character. So I've talked about, you know, they didn't do much with Enid. They made her a doctor. Ooh, big deal. Oceanside. That's maybe the most ridiculous part of this entire episode is that Oceanside is even there to like say, yeah, we vote on this. Because Oceanside
literally
is
literally who?
Yeah, I don't know who
that person is. What
happened
to all of Oceanside?
It's ridiculous that I don't know who the leader of Oceanside is. It's insane.
Are we supposed to think that that's the little girl that grew up in the last 5 years, but they just decided to make her a different actor because we wouldn't buy that she stayed the same, even though Enid had the exact same time jump, and we're supposed to think that she's 28 years old now.
And Henry for 6 years, yeah.
Right. Cindy Lou Who from Oceanside. I don't get it.
I don't even know why they're here at this point because they're not telling a story with him. I guess we did get to see the building and unification of these communities after all. It just didn't happen in the way or when we thought it would.
You
know, the 6 year jump, we were complaining, oh, we wanted to see, you know, this charter come together and how they define all these rules. And, you know, we still didn't get like the definition of those rules, but we did get the actual coming together of the communities. It just took way longer than we expected.
Yeah. I think I don't think they will in a million years, but I think it would be kind of cool if at the end of each season or half season, they have to amend the charter because of some lesson they've learned.
So they take Oceanside off? They're not pulling their weight. They do nothing over at Oceanside. They just lounge on the beach all day.
I don't mean take people off. I mean like add an amendment, you know. But yeah, like a First Amendment. Oceanside never was one of the communities. We were always at war with Oceanside. But I think it would be cool to continue to do something with this governance and the tensions, maybe, because you know you can get in a lot of trouble with the NATO style alignment. If you just let anybody in, it's like, oh man, Oof, are we really going to invoke Article 4 powers, whatever, for Liechtenstein? Really? Mm-hmm. Liechtenstein? Liechtenstein? We're gonna World War III for Liechtenstein? Am I the only one that thinks this is crazy? Like, yeah, maybe. I think it would be cool to explore some of that stuff in the upcoming seasons, but eh.
Yeah.
It is pretty cool that they're able to sign the document at this momentous time, you know, rechristened it, I guess. And what is that? That's also something like we think that the United States formed like in 1776. That was just a Declaration of Independence. It took years of wrangling and like, I think, two failed constitutions and governments before we actually got the one that stuck. Mm-hmm. So it's not even ahistorical that you would have these, you know, hiccups and stops and starts forming a government from this confederation. So yeah. Pretty cool.
In that moment, I don't know how I'm supposed to feel about it because it's kind of like, oh yeah, this has all been gross all along. But when Michonne tells Gabriel to sign the charter because it should be the leader of the council instead of the de facto leader of Michonne, I feel a little gross about that. Like, it's cool that Gabriel signs it, but he should have been, you know, as leader of the council, he should have been part of these decisions all along, and he's not been.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Trying to get right late, but at least they're getting right.
Yeah, you need to do that before things can get back to normal. Then we take a tour of the fair. Lydia wants to leave until she finds out that there's a movie playing later that night. And Ezekiel and Carol are shocked that their son was able to find a date for the movie. Me too.
Yeah. Can we take a moment to pat ourselves on the back with how kind of like right on we were with our Renaissance Fair pitch?
It's hilarious because the entire time I was just cracking jokes and thinking of like the dumbest things they could do, and they did at least one with Eugene in the dunk tank. I was happy to see that.
Eugene dunk tank. I thought like we had some cut material about juggling, and there's a juggler. There's like you can hear the faint Renaissance Fair music that's kind of wafting through the crowd, and the blacksmith showing off his fantastic inventions, which in this case is a tomahawk. You know,
sure, that he probably just salvaged from a museum.
Yeah, and they also made the point of like, what an adjustment for Lydia to go from the way she's living to not just like standard kind of hard scrabble hilltop or kingdom life, but in the middle of a fucking fair where they're going to watch a movie. Mm-hmm. And they showed her as like having, you know, kind of discomfort. I think the same way Daryl, even when he comes back to community, feels more safe and secure up in the barn loft. I think she's kind of got that same kind of feral yeah to her, and it's coming out in the way she feels about this. I thought that was nice because, you know, this show would be tempted to have a teenager just instantly fall into like, oh, it's a fair and I'm here with my boy and there's no problems at all. But, you know, she's very traumatized. Mm-hmm. And boy, howdy, doesn't even know the half of it till this episode's over.
Yeah. Then Luke tries to talk Boston Rob into joining him on stage for a musical performance. Enid and Boston Rob make their relationship official. He commits to Enid, but not to Luke. He says he's got to think about it. And then we go over to Kelly and Connie talking. Kelly's sad about Connie leaving without ever saying goodbye because everyone could be their last. Connie apologizes and then says that something happened that means babies are a sensitive subject to her. I don't know if she lost a child, you know, kind of like Michonne did, or if there's something within the community that they had and then some of those kids were killed. I don't know what it is yet, but hopefully
it's definitely they're planting a flag of character development here to allude to something, and something that like, because I thought this was really good, you know, Kelly saying, you left that saying goodbye, and in this world, every goodbye could be the last. So, like, what the fuck? And Connie's like, I was just overwhelmed. So that must be something, like, really big, right?
I assume so, yeah. And they've hinted at, like, the trauma that group has been through, you know, losing a whole bunch of members. And they're kind of the remnants of what appears to me to have been a much larger group. That traveled around city to city. Like, that they were in several communities and just kept, their numbers kept dwindling, and now here they are finally.
I wonder the thing, does it feel organic to you? The fact, I guess it, Yeah, does it feel organic to you the way they keep weaving relationships between these characters out of kind of nothing? Like, you know, Connie and Kelly are sisters, Magna and Yukima. Yukimo?
Yumiko.
Yumiko. I always want to do the Meek and Co. and like just flip them around, but they're in some sort of relationship, romantic relationship. Does that feel organic, or does it feel a little too matchy-matchy? I guess it's a really efficient way to establish characters because everyone's a two for one. Oh, these are sisters. Mm-hmm. So when we find out something about one, we find out something about the other. Oh, these are lovers. So when we find out something about them, it's efficient, but also the small group of survivors plucked out of a seemingly random group. It's wild that they're all kind of like coupled up and interconnected.
Yeah. I mean, I get what you're saying. It doesn't feel strange to me. Like knowing nothing about a group going in, I would assume that some of those people have pretty strong bonds mm-hmm. from before. Although we're getting further and further from before, right? So like at this point, those like, oh, this is my sister, or this is like someone I knew before the apocalypse mm-hmm. broke out and we were best friends in high school or something like that, or grew up together. Those things will start to feel like they should be fewer and far between.
Yeah.
But yeah, stuff like, you know, the stuff that develops during the apocalypse, I think, will just happen.
And I guess if you randomly flee a scene, you're probably going to flee in the pairs. Like, it's going to be like, you know, make sure your lover is safe and then you flee off with them. Make sure your immediate family member is safe and you flee off with them. They would kind of like maintain these nuclear bonds. And it has been one damn thing after another. Because the other thing is like, how is it that, you know, these people were like lovers in this case and there wasn't even a hint of it before this episode? But I guess, yeah, if there's been one damn thing or after another, there's not been time for that character development, I guess. It feels a little bit like some of this stuff is a discovery, though.
Yeah,
like in the writer's room. You know?
Uh-huh. We talked, you know, about some of the things that were happening in the fair here, but I wasn't sure if Daryl busting out his bike meant he was going to do some sweet motorcycle stunts. It's like build a ramp and jump over like the blacksmith booth or something.
Lord Daryl will now jump over the megabus, which we have welded together for this. No one has ever jumped a megabus before, not even in the old world. Yeah, that would have been.
Add one bus every year.
And finally figure out the purpose of the megabus. Holy shit.
Yeah.
The megabus was underserved this episode. I'm disappointed. Mm. There's still more fair, perhaps, to be celebrated after all is said and done, but I need more megabus.
Yeah,
Lord Daryl of Dixon jumping it would be chef's kiss.
Michonne tells Sadiq that she's leaving in the first group, and she's leaving Judith at the fair, wants him to watch her. He hints at Rosita's pregnancy, but doesn't elaborate, promising to fill her in when they get back to Hilltop, which immediately I was thinking, okay, well, Sadiq's dead. Sadiq's dead. Like you cannot promise I will fill you in when I see you next in this show. You just can't do it.
I'm shocked that all four corners of the love rhombus are still intact.
Yeah. No, it's ironic. He's the only one who gets out of that situation alive.
Yeah. I kept on thinking that, man, we're going to see one of the, because it's way sort of redundant. Superfluous. What did the what did Carol say? Like a movie when Lydia says it seems kind of shit. She used a word like some kind of highfalutin word for unimportant. But yeah, like not all four of those people surviving is necessary to the plot, and it's kind of an overstuffed part of the plot. I thought for sure. So I'm can't wait to see what's in store for the rhombus. The rhombus of love.
Yeah, I read an interview with like Nicotero and Angela Kang, who were talking about why they made some of the decisions they made on who to kill. And one of the things that they discussed is they wanted to keep the love rhombus alive because there's a lot of potential drama there that they it made it sound like they plan on mining that vein next season. But I thought they had mined it. I thought they had mined it this season. I thought like all the weird shit with like Eugene sending out his sexual assault troops to monitor Rosita.
I think they might.
Gabriel having like this crisis of confidence in himself. I thought that was done this season.
This is the best outcome. Like, if you start fracking on this well, tunnels are going to collapse. Good men are going to die. Yeah. It's going to be sad and tragic. You've pumped the well dry. Just leave the groundwater table intact. We don't need to apply hydraulics to this situation.
I feel like killing like the actual like biological father of the kid could have been the most interesting way through this. Gabriel and Eugene, who I think both are fairly ill-equipped to raise this child. Sadiq seems like the most level-headed, reasonable, rational.
He's a doctor, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess you can't kill Sadiq and Enid in the same go, because then you have no doctors.
But if they want to increase drama, kill Gabriel.
Yeah.
Because then suddenly there's some sort of love triangle, although Rosita doesn't, like, she's just not going to have it with Eugene. But you've got something there, but like, yeah,
okay, I'm very curious. Problem. I can add a new wrinkle. Okay. Jadis comes back.
Oh!
So you get the love pentagon.
Yeah, you get the love pentagon, and they're trying to split Gabriel's heart like a wishbone, you know, try to see who gets the big piece. And
yep, Jadis is all like,
"You're right.
I got a kid too," and she has a mailbox on like an empty watermelon rind.
I lacked your visionary genius to turn the love rhombus into the love pentagon. I was trying to subtract vertices, and you're adding them. Clearly, that's the way to go.
Yeah. Clearly. Addie apologizes to Henry for telling the adults where he was, and the shitty teens approach Lydia and tell her Addie and Henry probably have crushes on each other. Looks like it anyway. And not to cause problems in this community, because everything is just rosy. You know, there's no kids holding walkers in pits and torturing them. There's no internal strife between these teenagers. All is rosy until she showed up.
I thought that's what they were going to go for. They were going to go with the, hey, man, you know your boyfriend's a fucking narc? You think he's cool? He's actually super fucking lame, man. He fucking tortured zombie pits, a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, jeopardized their teenage tunnel. Now everybody knows about it. Like, yeah, it... But they just went with, like, I don't know, like, mean girl shit. I was Addie in on this? Because I also feel like, you know,
yeah,
was she just an innocent puppet of all this? Where they're like, hey, man, you should go shoot your shot before he gets coupled up. And she's just trying, and they're pouring the poison. It's real shitty, though. Real shitty to bully a girl with this experience, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, they've got to know, right? They've got to know who this is.
They're not very empathetic. I feel like Hilltop parents have failed the teenage generation because they're soft, but then they're not even soft in like a empathetic way. They're just soft and lazy and inconsiderate.
They weren't doing any trading at this trade fair. They got nothing to trade because they'd never done anything.
No. H is for Henry now because he's the best of them, and now his head's on a pike. Fuck you, blonde bang, chubby cheek, little piece of shit.
I do look at Lydia in this situation and I go, man, this must be insanely hard, because I remember how hard it was to navigate budding romances when I was a teenager, and I had experience dealing with human beings, not a bunch of skin wearing freaks. How she navigates this relationship, I will not know.
Yeah, no, it's going to be, intimacy is going to be hard. And they kind of showed that too, right? Like her, you know, Addie talking to Henry was just a sign of like, oh, better pack it up and run away because I'm going to be replaced. Like, she's got all that stuff internalized, but I don't know. I was actually looking forward to Henry and her relationship. I thought it's more interesting than Lydia herself. And now we're going for broke on the Lydia wagon. I'm curious to see how those decisions play out.
Hmm. All right. Next up is a scene where Tara forebodingly tells competent Bow Girl, and the guy that I'm going to call Second Glenn, like, we mentioned this before, but my God, they just really cast a dude, gave him the hairstyle, gave him all of Glenn features, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, gave him the same color shirt. Like,
and then you got Jacob the werewolf from Twilight has joined the group as well.
Okay. She's saying, okay, be safe going back to Hilltop. She'll be out in the next group. Michonne's leaving in the first group. Daryl and Carol are also going. Daryl asks Connie to feed his dog while he's gone and says goodbye to Henry. And then Ezekiel invites Daryl to live in the kingdom. He says, I'll think about it. And everyone heads out.
Yeah, and Carol saying goodbye to Henry and Zeke had a lot more meaning on the second watch through when you know Henry's going to, you know, and the plus, like, some of this stuff works on a rewatch, too, because, like, Connie's to talk about, like, goodbyes. You never know when they're going to be your last. And seeing all these kind of emotional goodbyes work even better the second time you watch it.
Yeah, I have in my notes here that I think everyone on this mission is safe and the kingdom should be worried. That didn't work out. I thought, look, all the badasses are on the road. The kingdom is full of drunken revelers. Like, there's no one there to protect it if things go bad. I've seen how this goes in Game of Thrones or something where everybody's camped out drinking and...
Everybody's worried about Hilltop, and we got to defend that because we don't think that the kingdom's even on the radar, but we did. We knew.
Yeah.
So
I saw him spying it out last episode. No, it's I was surprised by the way.
In fact, that'll be ironic when we get to the detent between Daryl and Alpha. I came out of that thinking, God damn, Alpha looks weak as shit.
Huh? What do you mean?
Yeah, when Alpha was like telling Daryl how it is and like they're carving up the territory and be on your way, I'm like, man, Alpha comes out of this looking weak as shit. But I didn't know about all the other
the
bloodshed that yeah. So like I and it just had me instantly eating my words.
Gotcha. So then we go to the highwaymen dispatching some walkers and meeting up with the road group. They show the raided cart that the Whisperers hit. This is the one that we saw in the very beginning of the episode. Knowing Hilltop is probably in danger, they decide to split up with Daryl, Michonne, and Carol tracking the Whisperers and the rest going on toward Hilltop. Prison Tats and British Bow Girl split up as well. This is the scene where they make
Miko and Magda. Couple, haven't earned their names yet for you, huh?
British Bow Girl, is that Yumiko? That's Yumiko, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Very highly competent and dangerous bow girl. I want to point out one scene. Like, I love Daryl riding at the head of these three other horsemen, one of them conspicuously with a sickle. So it very much looks like it's the four horsemen with death riding behind. Like, you know, they don't make a big deal out of it, but I saw what you're doing there, Angela. I like the symbolism.
I
do think that Daryl's the leader of the four horsemen for sure.
Need to make a big deal about it. I'm glad when they don't.
I think Eugene and Head Highwayman would have gotten along real well when Daryl's like, you know about these skin jobs? Like, yeah, I got the download. Like, I wish I could have seen them at the Dungeons and Dragons table.
God.
That Eugene's running, because like I feel like they're kindred spirits, right?
Uh-huh. The trouble is he only ever role plays as a cowboy, so.
Well, I was going to say, like, he's more from the, you know, those guys that do the creative anarchism, like they're actually Society for Creative Art, the ones that actually make the armor and weapons and bash into each other. I feel like Head Highwayman is that kind of nerd, and, you know, Eugene's definitely the tabletop kind of a blowhard intellectual nerd. But those types get on together sometimes, and we're robbed. We're robbed.
I feel like Eugene is the DM for sure, and Ozzy the Highwayman is like the unruly player who doesn't like wants to like somehow defeat the GM, right?
The DM's bane, for sure.
Later that night, Daryl's group gets surrounded by walkers. They fight them off, but the Whisperers show up in large numbers, led by Beta, and force them to drop their weapons. We'll get more on that.
Some awkward action. I'm starting to really cotton out that the Norman Reedus just doesn't want to rehearse for stunts.
Yeah.
No, man, you need to get real close in there. Just cut. Just show me with my two knives and then snicker snack. You know, there's a lot of awkward standing around, rotating from face to face to face, letting the zombies get close so that you can, you know, just do this claustrophobic stunt work. I think Norman Reedus is the nexus. He just doesn't want to do choreography anymore.
I did like the bow work. I thought, you know, rather than rush in, because we've seen time again where like the people will have bows on their backs and they'll just run in with their knives to get in close.
Take advantage of that range, yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was good.
But then it was kind of a moment when Beta stepped forward and, you know, Daryl's kind of like, fuck, I thought I killed, I threw you down an elevator shaft. What the hell?
Yeah, we thought you killed him too, man.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you could have gave us the girl. No one else would have had to die. Now that deal is done. And boy, howdy.
Mm-hmm. All right, we go back to the group leaving the kingdom to see it from Ezekiel's side. Eugene tells Rosita he's been working on a ham radio so the communities can communicate. There's a thinly veiled metaphor about communicating with each other and their strange relationship, which they immediately tear the veil off of. They come to some understanding this relationship is just going to be weird, but it'll work. And he invites her to play D&D with his group, his RPG group, and she shuts him down, aggressively shuts him down.
Don't put your luck. When Eugene was doing these repeater stations and whatnot and trying to get the ham links going, I thought it was to contact outside communities. It's a really hell of a good idea to have a ham radio network just to stay in touch the four communities amongst themselves.
Yeah, like, so they don't have to do this shitty, we saw how the relay communication worked, right?
The walkie-talkie relay, yeah.
It didn't work. Yeah, people just were like, I don't know, I got a message from Rick, I'll pass it on in like an hour or something. He's screaming about some bridge coming down. Walkers everywhere. Yeah, I'll get it to him when I get it to him.
Ezekiel's full pitch for the fair didn't go through. And, you know, if Michonne heard the whole pitch, she might have been on board from the beginning. You never know.
Oh, yeah.
But no, it's like having instantaneous, real-time, accurate communication would be huge for these communities.
Yeah.
It'd be huge for their morale. It'd be huge for their planning. It's a great idea. Good on you, Eugene. This is why we have you in the community. I was trying to push the ball forward.
I will say I still don't have a great idea how far apart these communities are, like physically.
I don't either.
Are they 50 miles? Are they 2 miles? It doesn't matter with the ham radio. Like, it would definitely matter with walkies, but a ham radio can communicate across the globe, you know?
Yeah, I would always assume it was like a 20, 30 mile, like... You know, that's like if you have roads, that's not anything with wagons and stuff. But if you don't have roads that connect, that could be a couple days journey, maybe through the back roads and keeping them clear is a lot harder. So,
don't have a ton of relay, or they didn't have a ton of relay people on the walkies, right? Like there were maybe a couple of relays between each.
I mean, we always heard it was like Alexander Relay 1. We never heard like if there's 2, 3, 4. Like, is it the Beacons of Amon Hill where there's like 12 of them?
Right.
But like, yeah, I don't have a good, I mean, they're all within the greater kind of Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Maryland area. But, you know, that could be 40, 50 miles apart and still have that be true.
Yeah. And we know that they've traveled into the city from time to time, like to get that wagon. They went into the city. So they can travel long distances.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
All right, Henry's looking around for Lydia. Tara organizes some cooperation between the communities on fighter training, and she's antsy to get moving because she wants to prove that she's a responsible leader.
I thought it was wild how the girls are just dripping off Henry once Lydia shows up, right? Hey, Henry. Really like your staff and your limp. Like, come on. They're throwing themselves at him.
I couldn't tell if that's what was happening there, because Henry reacts like, oh, I've got a girlfriend, ladies, just back off, you know, like that kind of thing. Like, he's very unconcerned about whether or not they're flirting with him. And I didn't know if they were.
I felt like they were definitely, trying to get up a shirt. Mm-hmm.
Well, now that
I don't know
Boston
why.
Rob's taken, you know, there are only so many, I don't know, less ridiculous teens to go around.
Well, it's weird because they introduced these girls as being specifically interested and sweet on Henry, and then two of them end up dead on the pikes at the end.
Yeah.
This redhead and Addie.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what they were trying to do. It's one of those things where it was a little awkward, kind of like the beginning, where it doesn't really matter, but it felt like a little road that went nowhere.
Yeah, it's like they decided, you know what? 9 people is not enough to kill this episode. We need to kill that 10th person, but we don't want to kill any of our actual characters. Let's just invent somebody to kill.
Yeah.
Which I think is, this has to be the shortest like character introduction to death arc that we've
probably
seen, even in The Walking Dead, right?
Third, yeah, it happens in the third act of an episode.
Where they're introduced as a character, not even where, like,
sure,
they haven't gotten enough lines.
I'm sure she was in the background riding a bicycle powered washing machine or something. And like, it's probably not literally the first time we've seen her, but it's right. It's got to be the first time she's got a line.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Normally they'd give her like a whole arc within the episode, right? Just to kill her later. But this time, got too many people to kill. Can't give them all arcs. All right, Luke and Boston Rob argue over the set list for their performance. Henry finds Lydia, who seems a little off. Alpha thinks about buying a sketch of Carol as the Whisperer baby passes by in the background.
Yeah, I thought that was like, I thought that was going to be the drama. She stole back the Whisperer baby. Like, I did not fully appreciate the fuckery that was going to be got up to here.
Oh, yeah.
But like, it was nice and menacing.
Movie theater. We can talk about it then, because I think they do something really cool there.
Yeah, I was like on pin. Like, once she showed up, that was so menacing. Like, I started thinking, oh, my God, this could, Hilltop's going to get overrun. You're going to see some kind of,
yeah, like set fire to the theater and lock everybody in, right? Like,
right. Inglorious Bastards, except for the bad flip of the bad guys and good guys around. Like, oh, shit. You know, I was on the lookout for that.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know how many of them were in there at that point. Like, if you see Alpha, you kind of assume there might be a lot more of them.
And I was thinking, like, because, like, notably kept on cutting the show, like, look, no one truly important is here. Yeah. Like, Jerry and his whole family, which had me gripped up, but, like, King Ezekiel's not there, Carol's not there, Daryl's not there, Michonne's not there. Like, it's just Lydia is the one, and I'm like, oh, and the way, I feel like this is all cut in a way that made it feel like Alpha might have killed Lydia. So, like, I, the whole time I'm just thinking this, every scene kind of dripped with menace because she's just this, you know, the Phantom Menace, lurking around the edges of the fair.
Also in the scene, Henry's pissed that the shitty teens said what they said to Lydia. He says it's not true that he likes Addie. He likes her instead. They finally get an uninterrupted kiss because Daryl is out of town. Henry hears one of his pipes banging.
He comes flying in from the next county and slaps him apart.
Henry hears a pipe banging. It's not his own. It's not his own. And he leaves to take a look.
Yeah, that thing's just rattling, shaking, about to break loose. Also, Lydia apparently was hiding out not because of the residual peer pressure, but because she shoved goat shit in these boys' faces. I thought as a funny joke, and then they pivoted over her shoulder. These guys are wiping like what looks like the goat shit off their faces.
Makes sense. She's a wild animal, hell, right?
Yeah. Like, they got Biff Tannered.
Yeah,
it's good. Just good, clean fun. Wow. Throwing dung in the bullies' faces.
All right, then Alpha continues shopping and pretends to be Debbie when Ezekiel asks her how she's doing. She, in turn, asks him how to point her toward the clothing booths so she can get some sweaters for what she sure is going to be a very hard winter, and he escorts her there.
The rest of this episode feels, as soon as she starts essentially saying, brace yourself, winter's coming, I felt like there's an unmistakable air of Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah?
Leading up, like, the palette, the quasi-medieval feel at the fair, the heads on pikes. It felt very, very early going season in Game of Thrones, which like is, in my mind, a compliment for sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, Game of Thrones.
Yeah, like Ned's head being on a spike in season one. Like, it felt very end of season one, season two, season three kind of stuff. Which, again, like I said, that's a compliment to me. But yeah, I want to know where to sweat. She's not nearly as good at a disarming airhead mom routine as Carol is.
Oh, no, like, she's not supposed to be, right? She's supposed to be fucked up. Like,
but why doesn't Ezekiel pick up on that? Like, I felt like she did it at the beginning and she just got more and more creepy and off-putting and weird, and King Ezekiel just took it as her being eccentric and charming, which I thought was a bit of a false note.
Look at the man in the mirror, Ezekiel. Like, you don't have to go far outside of his own home, outside of his own body, to find a weird and eccentric person, right? So,
no, you're right. Maybe he's uniquely susceptible to that, I don't know, charm, but I would have had more respect for Alpha if she was able to keep it together and be more you know, hey, yeah, I'm Debbie from Alexandria, and you don't know me, of course, because we've been estranged as a community for a while. Like, it,
right.
Instead of, like, pushing it more and more into kind of like, ha-ha, tee-hee, I'm a whisperer, tee-hee, you know, it should have been more smart. Like, if she had more guile, it would have made her appear to me more smart.
Yeah, it seemed like she couldn't help herself. Like, she was there.
No. Yeah, I get it. She's a weirdo. That's a perfectly fine explanation for her behavior.
Yeah.
And she's a weirdo gripped up about her daughter. Still. Like, you know.
All right. We go to the movie theater where the movie plays to a packed crowd, a packed house. They're playing Quackadoodle Doo.
Do you know why they're playing it?
I don't.
Because this shit's in the public domain. They don't have to check it with anybody, baby.
Sure. That makes sense.
I actually did some research because I remember one time my mom was at this store or something and she bought, like, this is early in the days of VHS. You know, VHS tapes were very expensive and she's looking for stuff that us kids can watch. And she bought like a 10 pack of something for like $10. And mm-hmm. she was like, I can't even believe what it is. And it was all just unlicensed garbage. Like, I've seen this Baby Huey cartoon. There's a couple of good ones. Like, there is like all those like Max Fleischmann Superman serials from like the 40s and 50s.
Huh.
Which have amazing animation. Super fucking racist against the Japanese, though. Oh, my God. Wow. You know, it happened. You know, Superman gets racist when we're fighting a world war against an ethnicity, apparently. But there was some good stuff, but yeah, there was a bunch of this baby Huey shit, and it was just all shoveled onto this cheap VHS with this as cheap packaging as you possibly can get. And I did smile real thinking like those cheap bastards going to the public domain to show a movie. Come on. Can't get anything from the last decade or two.
Right. Fast and Furious 1. Come on. How much can that possibly cost?
Yeah. Yeah. So, but that's why it's completely free.
Yeah. So here's where I started to get excited because I really liked what they did here. Henry is conspicuously absent during this and they don't show her sitting down, but you get it that this is Alpha mm-hmm. sitting down next to Lydia in this theater. Yeah, and I was like, oh, fuck, this is not going to go well.
Yeah, that blonde hair and big hat.
Yeah, from here on out, I'm just like, okay, I want to see what they do with this. And I was not disappointed, believe it or not.
There's also some, I will say that, like, even though I was smiling to myself that they chose this public domain thing, it is kind of interesting because a lot of these Baby Huey things revolve around this fox trying to infiltrate the community. And Huey's this dumb, big, dumb duck, but he's always like pulling Matt. And they showed at the climax of the scene, the Baby Huey pulling the mask off the fox to reveal that he's the villain. And that does, like, yes, it was a cheap license, but they used it to the hilt, which I thought was pretty. It could have just been background, but like, yeah, they made the most of the property of doing this thematic of like this person infiltrating the community. You know, not as a like one of the Walking Dead, but as the living. It's pretty punching above the weight. Also, while these films are public domain, the character of Baby Huey is not. There's this long chain of custody that took him from this no-name animation outfit in the 50s to he's currently owned by DreamWorks Animation through a complicated merger when Comcast bought Universal. So, like, Baby Huey, you can't go fucking wild with him, but all of his movies are public domain. Okay. He himself, his likeness, is owned by a multi-mega corporation, so Comcast.
You can't make new material with Baby Huey in it.
You couldn't sell a Baby Huey t-shirt, but you could screen this particular movie.
You know what else somehow they could have screened?
What's that?
Probably
Night of the Living Dead.
Night of the Living Dead, yeah. Totally.
They sure shit could. Wouldn't that break the universe? Because one of the wild things in this universe is zombies don't exist.
Yeah, which is why everybody has different names for them and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They could have shown like some of the quiet talking parts of the movie and not explicitly make it The Walking Dead or The Night of the Living Dead. So it's just kind of like a joke. Or like, it wouldn't be a joke, it'd be a nod.
The fans would be like, oh, they have Night of the Living Dead. Clearly, this is a shot from it. And like, they don't know what zombies are. It doesn't make sense. They would have got ripped to shreds for that, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, shoot, it's a good thing this show's never done anything to piss off its fans.
Look, they're turning over a new leaf in season 9, man. They can't have that shit slipping through the cracks.
I think fun with your fans, not at their expense, is it'd be preferable. I mean, yeah.
What if they were all shouting at the screen? What if they were like, "Yeah, rip those walkers apart, right? Oh, get those
skin those sickos, the dead-os, the dumb fucks. I don't know what all the things that could, the biters.
That'd have been fun. All right, we go back to Alpha capturing Daryl's group. Michonne tries to exert leverage over her by threatening her daughter, but Alpha declares her daughter dead, and she peels Daryl off this larger group, takes him to a valley where they've gathered thousands of walkers, and tells him that his community sucks and their community is awesome. And she sends Daryl back to his own community with a message to stay out of what she's declared as her territory, promising that he will know the border of it when he sees it.
Heisenberg's in. Get stay out of my territory.
He asks if she killed Lydia, which this is kind of, you know, this is all going to jump back and forth here, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, I remember thinking coming out of this, like, this is a fatal mistake the show's making. They're making Alpha appear weak, you know, like even that, because I thought that she had killed Lydia and then said, hey, these are my borders. Stay the hell out. Like, look, like rattled her saber and whatnot. But by the end of the episode, I thought, that's about right. That's proportional. You know, like, you killed a bunch of mine and you stole my daughter. So I'm killing nine of your randos and also showing you my unbeatable army, you know. But it's not like Alpha has an unlimited amount of people. Like, she doesn't really want an open war, right? She kind of hopes this will put them back on their back and that they can, she can kind of do her own thing, maybe build up her strength, whatnot. But, you know, this is, this war has been a lot costlier to them than it has been to any of the Hilltop slash Alexandria slash Oceanside, you know, slash Kingdom Alliance. So I thought, did you feel like this was pretty proportionate, or like, this is, I'm guessing, do you think this is smart politics by Alpha, like Game of Thrones type politics?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a bad move. I think it's a surprising move given what we've seen of Alpha so far. She doesn't seem the person to play these kind of games. It almost feels like this is a loss for her because it damages what I thought was her character, which is just sort of a psychotic lunatic who, if you wrong, will bring everything she's got at you just to prove her Alpha status. And like, yeah, this feels a little strange to me. And I guess it doesn't feel bad. It's just like, it feels like it's changing my perspective on who she is.
Because I don't. Yeah, it's weird because I don't know if we're supposed to understand that she's psychotic.
Well, like the challenges like, we've seen so far to her authority have always been met with just full on devastation. Right. Like if you bring a challenge to me in the group, I'm going to cut you open in front of everyone and demonstrate how I'm the Alpha here. And it doesn't feel like that's what she's doing in this situation, really.
Yeah. And I guess I think I understood her like killing her follower in a fit of pique as to show like the cost to her personal cost of like having this restraint, because like she's ironically doing what's best for her people and trying to keep them out of a confrontation. Unfortunately, she doesn't know that she doesn't understand the people, to paraphrase Rick Grimes, she doesn't know who they're fooling with. Mm-hmm. You know, like this is like Negan all over again, right at the time that they are banding together to remember like why they were able to beat Negan in the first place and the things that binded them together. Like she's coming in to fight World War II right as they're throwing a World War I, like, you know, remembrance parade, right?
Yeah.
So I felt like it was a perfect storm of Alphas not fundamentally understanding what makes this other group tick, with her not having unlimited, like, she has got a massive army of the dead, but she doesn't have a massive army of the living. In fact, she's taken a lot of, I mean, I believe that she could lose as much as 25, 50% of her people in the last few weeks, right? Mm-hmm. To like, think about all the ones we've seen go down. Almost lost Beta. She's like, you know what? Massive show of force plus a calculated retribution, and then that'll be the end of it. I think she really thought that that would work. And it's just not going to. So, but I like, I kept on thinking this episode is like, do I buy Alpha as this big bad, you know? Because like Negan turned into self-parody and I don't want that to happen with Alpha.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah, it's debatable for sure.
So we go back to the movie night where Lydia tells Alpha that she cares about her new community more than she cares about her mother. Alpha tries to explain that she made hard decisions, but Lydia realizes it's a bunch of bullshit and tells her to leave. And Alpha leaves after telling Lydia she was never one of them. You know, just lashing out, trying to hurt her because she can't get what she wants.
Yeah, I was really shocked that Lydia survived. And I started feeling, that's when I started feeling like, well, you know, Alpha was all talk, you know, she's all talk about marking her territories and there's no bite. There's all bark, no bite.
A couple of quick scenes here. Daryl joins back up with the rest of the group. Beta tries to talk to Alpha, but she wants to be alone. And she calls over one of these underlings and kills him, trying to make herself feel better. Taking out some of her frustration.
Which undercuts my argument about how at some level her living followers are precious to her. They're a precious resource because she just, I mean, I don't know, maybe this guy's like a, you know, low on the totem pole, dumb fuck, not worth anything.
Yeah.
But, you know,
probably. And then Daryl's
quick to drop a crow, quick to drop food on the ground. When he's beckoned and she's like, oh, God damn it. I didn't tell you to drop the food. You know what? Fucking die.
Daryl's group finds Sadiq tied to a tree. He points them toward the northern border, which turns out to be a row of pikes with the heads of a random group of survivors atop them. Or at least that's what I thought until I saw Enid, Rodney, Addy, Tara, Henry, some other people, Ozzy, and yeah, the redhead, the blonde tall guy from one of the groups that I don't really know. And you know, the episode title is The Calm Before, and I can't help but think that the storm is when they go in and kick the asses of the Whisperers, but I don't know. How could they not want to retaliate after this?
They're going to, but I think they're going to have to do it smart because Daryl's going to say, yes, we need to retaliate. But also, holy shit, there! How many walkers was in that canyon? 5,000 at least?
Yeah, thousands, certainly.
You know, that's an army that you could run any of these. Like, you amass that against one portion of the wall and it's going to fall and you're going to be overrun. You will not be able to maintain any one of these communities. And in fact, I don't even know how you fortify any, like all four of them to withstand it. Like they're, you know, they got the situation where there's, it's, yeah, but it's kind of like, what, isn't this like what, this is what like Julius Caesar is famous for, right? Like, or Napoleon massing all of his armies and smashing the enemy armies one by one with it. Cause they had to, you know, they had to protect territory and they couldn't afford to like be in any one spot. So they had to divide their forces and
it's the risk problem, right? You grow expand your territory. You got to protect all these borders. One big army could just jam through any point on your
you can't have you can't have a weak link. So that means everything has to be spread out equally, which means it's all vulnerable, right?
Yeah. And, so, and like you said, because there are so many communities here, it'd be harder to protect all of them. Because you have to protect all of them.
And where do you go to
devise systems that would do this? Like, I could imagine like a series of, you know, concentric layers of chain link fence that you can get sticks and poke through, right? And kill a bunch of walkers and fall back to the next one when that one gets overrun. Like, or just like thick, heavy concrete walls, like several feet thick might be able to do it, but like, The amount of construction required and the amount of materials required, I think, is beyond the capabilities of these communities right now.
Especially, again, when the zombie horde is going to be led by an intelligent beings that can find a weak point and amass there rather than... zombies, you can trick them into attacking where you're strong and butcher them to death. I mean, that's how World War Z was won, right?
Go back to the prison. Go find another prison. Barricade yourself in there. And die slowly, starving to death.
The mega bus. It's the only solution. You drive through. You got 30 windows on each side. 3 pikemen to a window. Like those old Greek tremines, only it's spears, and you just sail through a sea of the dead, just stabbing frantically at both sides. Don't ever stop the megabus.
They tried that. They tried that in Land of the Dead, and it didn't work out so well.
No, they got jammed up. See, you're the zombie expert. But no, it is an interesting problem because there is, on the other side, the Whispers provide no hard target. Like, their command, the only thing that's important to them is their central command structure, and that thing can just melt away and be anywhere.
I feel like you need Eugene making just a ton of bombs, Molotov cocktails, just whatever you can get for, like, AOE damage, and sneak in there with the commando team and just start firebombing their troops while they're in the
valley.
That's
what I was thinking too. Like, you've got like a quick decisive strike with lots of fire and whatnot that you can somehow spread over a wide area before the Whispers can do anything about it. But shit, how do you even do that?
I don't know. I don't think they have the resources.
It's an interesting asymmetric warfare that they've walked in, which has never been the case before. You know, the Saviors even had bases that they could be hit at and soft spots where they were vulnerable. I don't know about this gang. And now, like, that they can no longer hurt her with Lydia, it's going to be interesting.
And I'm curious to see what they do with the Hilltop. I assume the FNGs are going to step into the vacuum there. Now that Terra's dead. But honestly, I can't think, like, who's going to be the leader of that community?
I was thinking the Blacksmith, maybe.
Oh, he did say he's getting really fucking right?
Or maybe Boston Rob, Boston Rob becomes the leader.
That guy. Yeah, nobody cares about him.
Yeah, the only one that cared about him is dead. She's on a spike.
Yeah. The last two people who cared about him have died.
Yeah, it's not a good look, Boston Rob.
I don't know. Yeah, Enid's death sucks. I wish it had been Boston Rob.
And that's the thing, like, I was kind of like the whole time I was thinking, oh, the Highwayman, that's bullshit. I really like those characters. Ah, yeah. Oh, the Blacksmith's wife, this sucks. Addie? Ah, oh, and then like, oh my God, is it going to be Enid? Oh my God, it's Terra. Oh shit, it's Enid too. Mm-hmm. And then Henry.
And then like Henry, whatever, Henry.
I thought it might be Rosita. But the thing is, just when I thought, well, Henry, I don't give a shit about Henry, they have, you know, Carol, like Daryl just desperately trying to shield her from seeing this horror. And yeah. I got choked up, not because Henry was dead, but because Daryl cares so much about Carol. And they've done a very good job at restoking that relationship, that very kind of pure relationship. They're both really good actors. Like Norman Reedus might not give a shit about stunt work anymore, but he really is good at making me think he cares a whole lot about Lady Daryl or Lady Carol. Lady Daryl. Hey,
he might think of her that way. I don't know.
He might think of himself that way.
Question for you. Recontextualizing one of the previous things, the banging pipes that Henry goes off to check. Was that him being lured away by Alpha?
It must have been. I'm kind of bothered that she would know something so specific about the community. I kind of wonder if it's more of like she's an opportunist. She waited for something to peel him away. Okay. Because it does seem like, I'm wondering, I think Alpha's thing was she tried to kill a lot of people that were important to Henry as a symbol. And like one of the things about these girls flirting with Henry is like they were being marked for death, right? The Highwaymen were killed because they were targets of convenience. Everybody else had like, I think, maybe not Sadiq. Most of those people had like a personal connection to Henry in this episode.
Yeah.
You know? So I wondered if that was what they're trying to go for.
I wish
this was a deliberate thing. Like you took one of mine, I'm taking one of yours and everyone who cared about him.
Specifically Henry, like, because of the relationship they had makes a lot of sense. I'm a little disappointed in the way that they just kind of gloss over how they would get anybody out of this community, right? They're in the fair. How are they sneaking people outside of these gates that are surely still guarded? Like, how are they getting in and out of the community with Enid, with Terra, with like all these people?
I think some of those might have been like leaving as patrol detachments. like they were like heading out at first light or whatnot. Maybe. But yeah, you're.
How'd they get Henry out of there? Like,
yeah, Henry or Addie for sure. Addie for sure wasn't going out on any kind of patrol. So I don't know. Alpha had some other, like, maybe there's maybe there was more people than Alpha going through the community and like helping her out.
Yeah, I mean, that would have made a lot of sense, but they don't indicate that at all.
No, they
if
don't.
If they had like her look over at somebody and just kind of nod slightly, I would have gotten it.
Or if they were, if they pan into like a bunch of other bodies being scalped, you know?
Yeah.
But like, you know, because, you know, we're smart enough to see, oh, they did the one thing, they can do the other. And I'm kind of almost like thinking, as you know, we a lot of times bitch that shows don't trust us. It's like, well, they showed us a mechanism for how this can happen. We know that every one of these people are skillful at wearing skins and kind of blending in with stuff. So like, mm-hmm. I could see Angela Kang being like, come on, fuckers, connect the dots, right? But I do think
it felt more personal.
There
they were going with this like personal thing between Alpha and Lydia in the scenes that they showed us. And then they want us to assume that they were going with a more general thing in the stuff they didn't show us.
I think it's entirely fair to say that there's parts of this episode in the early and late going that are underwritten for sure.
Just slightly, though. Like, I don't want to take too much away from it.
Yeah. Because the payload that needed to land, I think, landed better than I could have ever possibly imagined. A part of it is like, I guess like this show can still sneak up on me like a few shows do, you know, like Leftovers. If they're able to wrench like a misty eye, that's because like they're getting past all my fucking defenses, you know, they're battering them down. But this show, it's kind of like I didn't really expect them to do something this big in the penultimate episode during, you know, the fair. Like I didn't like once we got to the end of the episode, I was ready to like, well, I guess, you know, Alpha's kind of fucking weak. I was genuinely surprised what they were able to do with it.
Yeah. And it's a change in the pattern of The Walking Dead, right? The Walking Dead in past seasons many past seasons has gone for huge moments as cliffhangers of the very last episode and cheaply, you know, like the Glenn's death and all those things. This is a change in that pattern. This is them going for more of a Breaking Bad type of thing, right? Where like you hit somebody with a huge monumental event one episode before the finale. And then I don't know what they're going to do next episode. I think it is called The Storm. I don't know how you get much bigger than this other than having the Walker attack, right? Like,
have to be a counterattack or something, yeah.
But it feels too soon for that. Like, I don't know if they're going to do like a bit of a time jump. They've already done that kind of at the end of this episode. They've jumped to winter. The heads on the pikes are gone when Enid and Daryl are out there. Lydia and Daryl.
I do like to switch the winter, and I wonder if they will do something with that, because that's one thing the show has never really done. Like, we've seen the vestiges of them surviving a winter where they're eating dog food together and stuff, but we've never actually seen them go through a winter. And it's so, man, winter is so fucking evocative for this kind of stuff. Yeah. Like going into a cold war, like a vicious kind of like Eastern Front battle or World War II. There's a lot of stuff you can do that entire palettes of emotional palette that they haven't even touched. And I'm kind of curious if they can do it, because it's kind of hard to pull that stuff off in Georgia, because it doesn't really, you know, you get a light dusting of the devil's powder down there and they fucking lose their minds. They don't know what to do with it. So like, I wonder if they'll do some location shooting in Canada or something. They kind of sell the winter soldier routine they're wanting to do here.
Yeah. Now that they're on the East Coast, I feel like I'd love to see a blizzard, you know, I'd love to see like, at the same time, I know Walking Dead would cheap out and it'd be like this nasty CG cloud.
Maybe
this, you know, this fog that's standing in for Blizzard with a couple of real flakes laid over it.
But it'd also be cool, because if I do believe that the kingdom is kind of on the teetering on collapse, and now that you've got this pall that's cast over the middle of the fair and it's the winter is coming, like there could be some really cool kind of siege type stuff you could do with the kingdom.
I would have so many questions though. How do the Whisperers survive the winter? Like, they don't have like stores of food, as best I can tell. The communities themselves have a hard time surviving the winter.
I would think the walkers would freeze to death too. Like
the Whisperers, like they don't have real warm shelters or clothing or anything.
Well, they're
right?
Zombies. How do they keep the zombies from freezing? Like, their manpower might just like peter out. Maybe that's how there's a truce. Like, you know, the walkers freeze and the communities have to hunker down, and that's where I wonder if that's where they'll lead it. Because winter like I said, Game of Thrones reference incoming, but winter is coming, and some of the shots they had establishing that, like the row of pikes that are empty, and they had like a, what I would consider a beautiful kind of like dawn shot of the snow falling and that one flake that they captured, you know, landing on the Hope amulet, the Hilltop Hope Henry amulet. All that stuff was really, really beautiful and worked really nice.
Yeah, we've kind of talked about that last scene a fair bit, but let's talk, I guess, about the Sadiq scene where he tells the community a story about the death of all of their friends, and about coming together and honoring them rather than this warning that Alpha wanted him to deliver. I feel like, and this entire time they're showing, you know, these survivors that end up not surviving, fighting back in this barn, where they're being held, and you know, it's all slow motion, and Enid's got her dukes up, and Henry's standing there like a dumb fuck. I feel like if he had a stick, it'd be all over. Like, forget about it.
Right.
But he didn't know what to do without a stick. He's looking around. He's trying to find a broom handle, a rake, something he can use. Stick.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a smart thing. It's like, you know, so many of the people in Negan's era went down helpless, like on their knees, you know, not exactly begging for their lives, but it felt not fair. And this was nice that, like, that's what the Alpha wanted to happen. But because, and only because, the kingdom had decided to trust and try something new with a band of outsiders, like that small change that Carol suggested 3 episodes ago led to this, you know, kind of heroic end for these characters who did die, yes, but they died, as Sadiq pointed out, as heroes. And I think that's all very thematic, and it ties in. You know, if Carol hadn't done that, the Highwaymen wouldn't have been there. They would have had these grim executions, and Sadiq wouldn't have this kind of hopeful moment of them all fighting like heroes together to save themselves because they're family.
The community could fall apart right then and there.
Yeah, like all these various decisions, Michonne deciding to open her heart, all these kind of like, I don't know, I like shit like that. The idea that like everyone's individual decisions to trust and be open and to love are rewarded in ways you can't even imagine. Even in these, like, you know, this is a dark time, but like it's really easy to imagine it had been darker without these individual epiphanies that they've had. And I fucking love that. It's really, really good writing and really good thematic stuff.
Yeah, we'll see. Lydia lays down all her hope at the end of this episode in front of Henry's pike. So I don't know what her deal is going to be going forward. She could definitely be scarred by being essentially the cause of this entire thing. But
that's what I'm thinking, that like the survivor's guilt is going to be something else.
We'll see. We'll see in the storm.
Do you think they'll have that blonde bang punk giving her any shit about like, oh, look here, little new girl, you got us all killed. Fucking loser.
Yep. All right. That's it. That's it for the episode.
Yeah. If you, we've got one more episode. We might do feedback after next episode. If we have a lot of feedback, we might kick and do an actual like end of season wrap up like we've done before. But we'll see. We'll see how much how big our mailbag is. But if you got some stuff to say about this season and our coverage of it, send it in. Now's the time. WatchingDead@baldmove.com. We'll be back next month for the, not next month, we'll be back next week for the finale of season 9, or perhaps we'll be back with another wrap-up episode with some feedback. Either way, there should be lots of good stuff if you're a Walking Dead fan. We've in the background been playing these Let's Plays of the last Telltale season. If you've ever heard of our stuff before, we play this thing called Bad Guy X. Bad Guy Clem is one of our oldest characters, and we take Clementine, the sweet girl, we turned her into a monster, and now we're trying to do the same thing with her ward, adopted ward AJ. It's been kind of heavy work making this stuff funny, because it's a bunch of child soldiers this season. They saddles a lot of emotional material to make fun of, but we're doing our best. All that stuff is available for club members if you want to celebrate that. And then there's a lot of good pulp stuff going on right now. If you want to keep the kind of good pulpy vibes going, we're currently covering The Boys over on the Department of Homelander Security feed and the Bald Move pulp feed. And we've also covering a really good pulpy show Lovecraft Country over on our Off the Clock premium podcast. So there's a lot of stuff. I hope you stick with us over the next few weeks. But we do have at least one more week of The Walking Dead Season 9 to look forward to. Hope to see you back next week. Until then, I am Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.